This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is visiting Iraq on a surprise trip. It is the highest-level visit by an American official since President Trump's pullback of U.S. military forces in Syria. Mr. Pence met with the president of Iraqi Kurdistan, Netrivan Barzani, in a move meant to reassure U.S. allies in the fight against the Islamic State. Here is Pence on his mission, then Barzani.
To reiterate the strong bonds forged in the fires of war between the people of the United States and the Kurdish people across this region.
At this particular time is an important indication of your continued support to Kurdistan and Iraq.
Pence got a classified briefing at Iraq's al-Assad air base, and while there, he spoke by phone with Iraqi President Adel Abdel Mahdi and met with U.S. troops. Syrian Kurds sustained a bloody Turkish assault last month, seen by many as the result of President Trump's border pullback decision. Today, a car bomb exploded in a Turkish-controlled northern Syrian town, killing at least three people, this according to Turkey's defense ministry. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a U.K.-based war monitor, put the death toll from the explosion at nine, including four from the same family, and it said that many of the wounded were in critical condition. Iran is a week into a major shutdown of internet access. It's prompted the United States to sanction the Iranian official overseeing the outage. The web shutdown followed violent protests when Tehran raised the subsidized price of gasoline by 50% on November 15th. The death toll is believed to top 100. The price move adds to the strains on Iranians facing hardship in an economy already weakened by U.S. sanctions, government corruption, and mismanagement. More news at voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. In Colombia, President Iván Duque has put the capital, Bogotá, under curfew amid continuing protests against his conservative regime. We have a report from AP correspondent Sarah Bassett.
Duque says he is invoking the rarely used measure to contain ongoing clashes between police and demonstrators. Shortly after, officers began pushing back thick crowds of protesters banging pots and pans in the storied Plaza Bolívar. The curfew comes after an estimated 250,000 people took to the streets in one of the nation's biggest marches in recent history. While it started out peaceful, the demonstration ended with scattered skirmishes between protesters and police, with three dead. The upheaval takes place as Latin America is experiencing a tide of discontent, with large demonstrations taking place in countries including Chile, Bolivia, and Ecuador, where citizens frustrated with their political leaders are taking to the streets. I'm Sarah Bassett.
A former CIA case agent has been sentenced to 19 years in prison for an espionage conspiracy with China. We have a report from AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
55-year-old Jerry Chung-Shing Lee has been sentenced in federal court in Alexandria after his guilty plea earlier this year to conspiracy to commit espionage. Prosecutors say Chinese intelligence officers gave Lee more than $840,000 and that Lee likely gave them all the information he had from a 13-year career as a CIA case officer. They wanted a prison term of over 20 years. Defense lawyers who wanted 10 years say the government never showed that the money came from China or that Lee ever carried out any plans to deliver government secrets. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Hong Kong's High Court has reinstated, at least for a week, a ban on anti-government demonstrators wearing face masks to hide their identities. The ban was initially imposed in October under rarely used emergency powers in the Chinese semi-autonomous territory. The latest decision comes as police brace for possible unrest during elections scheduled for Sunday. Pro-democracy candidate Chris Chan.
After a massive moment, I think an election can reflect the public opinion to some extent. Another point is it is time for us to calm down and tell the government in a civilized way what we want to do. As for myself, I am working in cultural and art industry, and I think it is very important to use my professional skill to contribute to rebuilding the society at this moment.
More news at voanews.com. There is also a convenient, easy-to-use mobile app. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Organization that are asking, what next? Philip News, he needs to step down. And if Frelimo understands that, in fact, should not have a president, a head of state, linked with this type of scandal, should remove him from there. And it should be Frelimo doing it, not just Frelimo asking.
The Mozambican main opposition party, RENAMO, demands the immediate resignation of President Philip Nyusi.
When we made sign the presidential candidate to peace declaration, which was undertaken during the national prayers we held on 4th May thereabouts, basically was to commit the parties or the presidential candidates to use the existing legal remedies.
The Public Affairs Committee in Malawi steps up efforts to resolve the country's rising political tension.
The president, as the president of the ANC, would have initiated processes in his own organization to fire Mr. Bongo, to take action against Mr. Bongo and all the other senior leaders who have been at the center of massive allegations of corruption.
And the South African main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, welcomes the arrest of former Security Minister Bongani Bongo. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Spokesperson for the parliamentarians from the Mozambican main opposition party, RENAMO, is calling for the immediate resignation of President Philip Nyusi. Mohamed Yassin says Nyusi's resignation will enable a thorough investigation into allegations he personally benefited from a $2 billion debt scandal. The party's call came after a court filing in the U.S. alleges Nyusi, a former defense minister, benefited from the $2 billion borrowed from Credit Suisse and Russia's VT Bank to buy military and fishing vessels. For more about the resignation, I reached RENAMO's parliamentarian Mohamed Yassin.
This amount of money was actually taken away from the country without a proper channel. And let's also remember that the parliament 2 years ago, we had an inquiry at the parliament in order to find out who benefited from this money. And now we're hearing from Brooklyn that our president also benefited from this money and a scandal for the nation. And we think that it's reasonable that the president steps down in order to allow the court to call him to answer from this felony. That's what we're saying. We are no longer accepting that someone who's mentioned on this scandal in the U.S. can be the president of the country. A part of that, it's also good to mention that in U.S., we've got to know that this money was used actually for election in 2014, the time when President Nyusi was elected. So we're saying that Frelimo used a debt money to elect a president, which is up to today is in power. So we think that it's enough reason for him to step down.
But Mohamed, some of his supporters are saying these are mere allegations and have not been proven beyond any shadow of doubt that he benefited. How do you respond to that?
Well, let us start by saying that from the beginning, Frelimo says that they had no information about this, what they're calling today allegations. And the second, it was clear for every Mozambican that our president didn't know anything about this money. And now they're calling it allegations. Let me put the question this way. If a president is mentioned in the court, even if it's allegation, would he or would he not step down to allow the country to investigate further, having in mind that the president has immunity? It's fair enough that he should come out of his immunity to allow international court or a national court to work freely. And if President News doesn't do this, it means again that he collaborates with this scandal. We have no other choice here. The money was used illegally. $10 million was given to Frelimo to support elections. This is illegal. So if it's illegal, it means that the new president was elected through illegal means. There's nothing there to discuss.
Mohammed, some of his supporters are saying that because Renamo lost the recent election, it is harping or hanging on to this to stay relevant just to force him to step down because he defeated you in the recent presidential election.
What is happening in the court now in Brooklyn has nothing to do with election. Election was rigged, big time rigged. If you try to see the report of the European Union, you try to see the report of the U.S. Embassy, you see the report of SADC, it's all clear that those elections were rigged. The main point here is that the country lost or has to pay $2.2 billion. And this concern is not only for Renamo or MDM. It's a national concern. Because several times the president came out saying that he doesn't know anything about this money. And today we're saying that he's been mentioned, either proven correct or not, for the court to work with information that today we have it. He needs to step down, so he will not have immunity to be able to be called to the court. And besides of that, let us say that they're just allegations. Remember, we have more than 20 people in Mozambique arrested since the beginning of the year, some of them since last year, because of those allegations. Why should we single out the president? We even have a former minister of finance in South Africa arrested because of this allegation. The son of the president is arrested because of the allegations. Why not Filipinos?
What happens if he refuses to step down as you are demanding?
I understand that Renamo now is speaking the voice of people. Because when we called the government, the parliament, in order to justify this money, when we got the news 3 or 4 years ago, it was because we were receiving pressure from the people. What we're saying is that the country will have a disorder, not from Renamo, but the people. There's so many social organizations that are asking, what's next? Filipinos, you need to step down. And if Frelimo understands that, in fact, should not have a president, a head of state, linked with this type of scandal, should remove him from there. And it should be Frelimo doing it, not just Renamo asking.
Mohammed Yassin is the spokesperson for the Mozambican main opposition party, Renamo Parliamentarians. He spoke with me from the capital, Maputo. Malawian government officials say they are open to meeting representatives of the Public Affairs Committee, or PAC, in the effort to find a solution to the ongoing political stalemate. PAC, a religious organization, is meeting opposition and civil society groups to end the rising political tensions. This following the disputed general election, which led to a series of demonstrations and a legal challenge to the outcome of the polls. To learn more about the efforts to resolve the ongoing political tension, I reached Robert Fieri, Chief Executive Officer of the Public Affairs Committee, OPAC.
For us hearing that they are ready to engage Public Affairs Committee, that's not really a surprise, because as an organization, we have had several interactions which have been positive. I think what we have been waiting is for the specific date when we can engage the head of state. But as regards to the doors being open, I think it has been our conviction and belief that the door would open. It was just a matter of time, given that the head of state was also engaged at a time when he was intending to see us. He had gone to United Nations General Assembly, and later when we wanted to engage him, he had left for Africa-Russia Summit. So we have been aware in terms of some of the engagements, because the office has kept us abreast in terms of the itinerary of the president.
What is the Public Affairs Committee seeking from meeting President Atapita Mutarika and his team?
The idea was to sell the idea of dialogue, in which case the president welcomed the idea of the dialogue to be initiated. But within the same context as we had discussed what could be done, we were guided by the head of state to engage others, namely the United Transformation Party, the Malawi Congress Party, the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, who were seen to push for the resignation of the Malawi Electoral Commission chairperson. So we did all first-round engagement with these stakeholders as per guidance from the head of state. And now meeting the head of state is to give feedback in terms of what has been the response from these parties regarding the dialogue. And once we do that, we should expect perhaps reaction in terms of the head of state, in terms of the national dialogue that has been planned and we have been talking about. So really is to report back, give feedback, and share some lessons we have had after engaging these other stakeholders or concerned parties in the dialogue.
After meeting these concerned parties in the dialogue, what was the overarching impression or feedback?
Well, we have been very clear even in the press statement which was issued by the mediators. The overall outcome was that all the stakeholders or the concerned parties were ready for dialogue and they were looking forward to have the dialogue soon rather than later. So there has been overwhelming, commitment to national dialogue. Of course, in a dialogue, we have to respect other observations which were made, and those observations cannot be discussed publicly at the moment until we engage the head of state.
Looking at your effort to resolve this political stalemate, some people are suggesting that your effort could undermine the legal challenge of the outcome of the general election, of which the Malawi Congress Party and the UTM are legally challenging the result, saying that it was fraught with irregularities and rigging. People are questioning whether your efforts will not undermine those legal wranglings in Malawi.
Well, I think the fact of the matter is that there is no undermining of the legal rights which have been exercised by the two parties. First, when we made sign the presidential candidates to peace declaration, which was undertaken during the national prayers we held on 4th May thereabouts, basically was to commit the parties or the presidential candidates to use the existing legal remedies if there was any problem at all. So having gone to court, basically they have just operated within that framework of peace declaration which was signed by the presidential candidates. As such, in terms of the mechanisms to resolve conflict or conflict management, it wasn't just a matter of looking at legal redress only, but also within the same document, we recognize that dialogue, mediation, or advocacy were other means which could support the outcome of the court. For example, they feed into each other. Basically, if you prepare the minds of the followers of the parties or the presidential candidates or those who are concerned in terms of the outcome of the court, and you come up with a general consensus, it does help. It doesn't undermine the legal outcome at all, but it does contribute in terms of what scenarios you can come up with the legal outcome. You can also manage in terms of the reaction of the public.
Robert Fiery is the Chief Executive Officer of the Malawian Public Affairs Committee, or PAC. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The South African main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, or DA, has welcomed as a positive step the arrest of former Security Minister Bongani Bongo. The South African police briefly arrested and released Bongo after accusing him of meddling with an investigation into graft at the state power utility firm Eskom. Supporters of the governing African National Congress, or ANC, say the arrest is a strong indication of President Cyril Ramaphosa's commitment to his campaign promise to root out corruption. The Democratic Alliance, however, sharply disagrees. For more of the opposition party's reaction to the arrest of the former minister, I read Sally Molati, spokesperson for the Democratic Alliance.
The Democratic Alliance welcomes the arrest of Bongani Bongo, the former Minister for State Security, because the background to this issue was that when Parliament was deliberating on whether or not to establish a committee to investigate allegations into state capture, the evidence leader for Parliament, Mr. Advocate Fanara, revealed to Parliament that Mr. Bongo had made advances of a corrupt nature to him. And on the basis of that, the Democratic Alliance reported Mr. Bongo to Parliament's Ethics Committee so that he can be investigated. Additionally, we also laid charges with the South African police services for corruption, because it is illegal to attempt to bribe an individual. So we welcome the arrest because it is high time that those who played a role in abetting state capture or in protecting other leaders in government and in the ANC, so that the ground for state capture is fertile, face the consequences of the law.
Some people are suggesting in South Africa that this is a clear indication of the president keeping his promise that he will fight corruption, and the arrest and charge of this former minister is an indication that he's still committed to the fight against corruption. What is your reaction to that?
If that was the case, the president, as the president of the ANC, would have initiated processes in his own organization to fire Mr. Bongo, to take action against Mr. Bongo and all the other senior leaders who have been at the center of massive allegations of corruption. In this case, the president's hand has been forced. It was forced because the Democratic Alliance laid charges. And once you lay charges, it is upon the criminal justice system and our law enforcement authorities to investigate those charges and ultimately to arrest those who face serious allegations so that they can be tested in court.
We also heard reports that mediators in South Africa say an agreement has been reached between trade unions and the South African Airways to end 8 days of striking, which has grounded the airline. Your reaction to that?
Well, it would be a welcome development because the deadlock was unsustainable. The impact of the deadlock on the country's economy, on the future of SAA, and also on the welfare of the employees was unsustainable. However, the key issue here is, should the South African government continue to own South African Airways? We believe that not, that it is high time that a private equity owner is found for South African Airways so that the state can focus on its core business, which is not to run an airline, but to make sure that it creates policy that create an enabling environment for investments to take place and that it provides social services to the residents of the country.
Basoli, some people are suggesting that the government has been willing and has invited private individuals or groups or organizations to invest or take over the affairs of the South African airline, but that has not been forthcoming. So in your case, what does the Democratic Alliance suggest is the best way forward?
Look, there are two views on that. One, we are advocating that airline staff, particularly for SAA, be regarded as essential services so that there can be limitation in terms of their right to strike because of the massive consequences that the economy suffers when there is a strike. And the second question is about the future ownership of SAA. Government could have done it in the past, but we are now here and we still believe that by restoring good governance, by appointing the right board leadership and making sure that there's good governance, government can begin to send a signal of restoring credibility in SAA and restoring credibility in its financial standing in society so that it is attractive for potential private equity owners to invest and take it over.
Solly Malatsi is the spokesperson for the South African main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, or DA. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. This week, the Summit of Heads of State of the East African Community, or EAC, scheduled for November 30 in Arusha, Tanzania, was postponed, allegedly due to a lack of quorum. However, some analysts attribute the reason for the postponement to regional tensions among member countries. Charles Mwanguya Mpaji is the Kampala Bureau Chief of the East African newspaper. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, and began by asking him about the situation on the ground.
Over the last few years, the regional summit of the heads of state has been troubled. During the leadership of President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, the community hardly held any successful summit. And now, under the leadership of President Paul Kagame, also the summits have become difficult to hold because it's difficult to bring all the leaders of the six member countries together in one room to have a discussion about the East African community. So the community has suffered at two critical levels. One, it has suffered at the level of political cohesion among its leaders, but also that has led to another major challenge, which has been the funding of its secretariat in Arusha to be able to execute some of its responsibilities, as some of the governments hold back the money or are reluctant to put in money. Obviously, that holds back a lot of other activities.
The tension between Rwanda and Uganda and between Rwanda and Burundi maybe could not allow for a fruitful summit to take place.
Yes, the leaders will deny that. They will say there are other factors delaying, but you know, President Kagame is the leadership and is supposed to handing over, moving towards handing over someone else, and he has taken over from President Yoweri Museveni. But yes, we've had, there's been tension, serious political disagreement between Kigali and Kampala for a time. From February 28th until today, common border between Uganda and Rwanda remains closed, but also movement between Rwanda and Burundi has been difficult for quite a long time, with counter-accusations between the leaders of the two countries over who is sponsoring dissident groups operating or destabilizing forces operating in either in the other's territory. Now, that, if you put that together with what we have seen before, a time when on major infrastructure projects that link the actual people of the East African community, like the standard gauge railway, the discussion at some stage shifted to a coalition of the willing. The discussion about moving on with a political federation had also moved towards a coalition of the willing. So there is no harmony among the leaders, and some of these leaders hold a lot of sway. Now, the two you're talking about, President Yoweri Museveni and President Paul Kagame, have been in power longest of all the leaders of the East African community. You have, in that mix, you had President Pierre Nkurunziza of Burundi, who has also been around longer. In Kenya, President Uhuru Kenyatta is supposed to be relinquishing power. In about a year from now, President John Pombe Magufuli will also not be around too long. That creates a very difficult situation for the community to sit and have a discussion and push forward a common agenda. Because looking around, they think they know what should be, what is good even for the region and for their own countries, and others are thinking institutional. That creates obvious disharmony.
The old East African community, which comprised Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania, collapsed in 1977, primarily due to tensions between then-presidents Julius Nyerere of Tanzania and Idi Amin of Uganda. Do you see this bloc surviving the current tensions?
Yes, this community will hobble on because the people believe in it. At a broader level, people believe in it. Mm-hmm. You'll be amazed. Ugandans don't speak a lot of Kiswahili, but at every function I have been, they sing along the East African anthem much better than they sing along the Ugandan anthem, which is composed in Kiswahili. Meaning that at a people level, that hunger is there, and it, I believe it will also be the leaders who might have personal interest.
Charles Manguhia Mpaji is the Kampala Bureau Chief of the East African newspaper. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala.
This weekend, tune into Music Time in Africa. Hey everybody, I'm Heather Maxwell. I've got an exciting playlist of amazing tunes from Morocco, Ghana, Ethiopia, Benin, South Africa, Nigeria, Gambia, and Tanzania. You'll also meet Kenyan singer-songwriter Dan Aseda. He just released his new album, Benganology, and Bill Odidi gets him to talk about it and play a few fresh samples.
The kind of traditional, classic
song of the week from Gabon is Yaya Yobe, a gorgeous tune by Chanel Lakinda. Le feu, le feu, le feu. Kwame Ofori joins me to present that. And finally, my vintage tune is polyphonic music from the rainforests of Central African Republic. Don't miss it. Music Time in Africa, 1505 and 20500 Universal Time. We'll be right back.
and you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, he is the former Ghanaian ambassador to the U.S. He is also a medically trained physician, business executive, and a philanthropist. Dr. Kwame Bewe-Duse launched his latest book titled Thrive Despite the Odds in Springfield, Virginia, Saturday. The book traces his roots to where he currently is in an effort, he says, to encourage the youth to learn from his journey. Think positive, never envy, and God will bless you is the creed Dr. Bewe-Duse lives by. He joins me live right here at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. to talk about his new book. Good afternoon and welcome to Nightline Africa, Dr. Bewe-Duse.
Yes, good afternoon.
How are you?
Peter, I'm all right.
Wonderful. So tell me about this new book. Why did you write it?
I wrote this book mainly for the youth.
Right.
Especially the African youth, because they are the future. I wanted them to move from the old negativity to think positive and act positive. And to use the opportunity to create jobs by doing investments, and also share my experiences throughout this process with them. And hopefully that can uplift Ghana, and for that matter, Africa.
Yeah. So with this book, what was the overarching message in this book to the youth and people that you want to help better their lives or improve their lives and living conditions?
Yes, basically is to let them look at life from a positive angle, to know that you have to work hard, that integrity is very important, and therefore the truth is very important, and to always persevere, because whatever that you start to do, you have difficulties. It could be cynics within you, or the difficulties of business, for instance. And if you fail one, you don't have to ever give up. You should keep on doing it till success is yours. And even when you are successful, you try to share it with others and also try to give back to society. That has been my mantra in life, and I felt it's very important that we share it, because there's sometimes a lot of false and lies and innuendos, and you need to bring out the truth. It's very, very, very important.
Talking about this, the criticism of the youth nowadays is that they are drawn to quick money, making money quickly, being successful without going through a process to get to the top. How does this book address this, you know, to change the mindset, to work hard, to go through, you know, the process to get to the top?
Yes. It's very important that we as Africans should be always documenting our life stories, our experiences, so the youth can share on the social media instead of the negativity that is saturating it. It gives them a positive avenue to get out of this idea of trying to get money quick. You never get money quick. You have to work hard. When we initially started our EO group, it was way back in 2002. It's almost 17 years now. We are now benefiting. So you don't need to rush. But if you are lucky and something comes your way, then so be it. You take it and you move on. And most businesses will give you a story of trying 1, 2, sometimes 10 times before they are successful. And even when you are successful, you have to work hard and keep at it, do your research and development, so that you don't get out of the loop and then somebody takes over and you are out. Or maybe the business environment changes and you are not aware. So it's a constant activity of hard work and perseverance. And then you do your research and think positive. Very, very important.
So how do you engage the youth, based on what you have written in this book, to follow the journey or your experience that you've had?
Yes. We initially will put this book on the electronic scale, and then I have a foundation which is dedicated to youth development. We do workshops mainly in Ghana, in the U.S., but we've done some in Canada and in the United Kingdom and some parts of Europe. Basically, we try to give them, you know, the youth, sometimes they are curious. It's their nature. They are exuberant. And that's where the energy is. You need to show them a good way to use it in the positive sense, you know, and to avoid the negativities of drugs and smoking and, you know, alcohol, living healthy, and also looking for good businesses that can bring you know, and create jobs is one of the most effective ways for Africans to be able to economically empower ourselves and also have our dignity. Mm-hmm. So workshops, social media, and some form of activity and correlation with other foundations, and also influencing governments to move towards focusing more on the youth and giving them avenues for startup companies, because the government alone cannot create all company, you know, jobs. Yes. Mm.
You are a diplomat apart from being a philanthropist, yes, and a medical doctor. Politically speaking, all across Africa, you see some people getting political appointments, and overnight they are putting up structures, they are doing this and doing that. Some say that is an attraction for the youth because they see that once they get into politics, that is their way to the top. How do you engage them to change their mindset about
that? That is a very wrong perception that we need to really engage. In my situation, I did most of the foundations of my business and got to a stage where we signed the deal, and if we were lucky, then we moved with it. You know, going to government, I had to really cut off my pay and lose a lot of money and opportunities in life. But you have to also serve in the public and make sure that that is not the way to make money. You have to really go into the private sector to make money, which is what I did, you know. And if you go into that wrong method of going to politics just for money, then it becomes very bad for Africa, and for that matter, very bad for the community and the nation. It's very important that we make them aware that when you go into public service, it's service to your nation. Then you can go into business as a private person and also help. And then when you come out, maybe in retirement, you could do philanthropy, where you virtually help and give out what you've been able to acquire, you know. So that is very important. We don't give them a wrong perception about going to public service or government. Yes.
Take me through the book from your infancy, going to school, studying hard, sometimes somebody say burning the midnight oil and all that, to get to where you are now.
Yes, I came from a family on both sides of my father's side and my mother's side, very rich. They believe very much in family values of integrity, education, business, and philanthropy. And I even though it was unfortunate I lost my father at the age of 4, my mother was able to nurture me to always not envy, but think positive and God will bless me. So that mantra has really invigorated me to be able to focus in life. All the challenges that I had in life throughout my education in Ghana, even when I came to the United States, they wouldn't even let me practice because some people didn't like the idea that there's a medical school in Kumasi and they didn't bring the documents on time. I had to virtually spend a lot of years fighting for that in order for others to enjoy, and eventually they gave me the opportunity. So it's hard work that you have to really, you know, focus on, and you never give up. And it's those things has really helped me. And even though I was a physician and very interested in medicine, still is, but I always had the other view that I need to add business. Mm-hmm. So in the modern world, one other message I tell the youth is you don't have to be tunnel shaped and just look at one profession. You have to be multiple, you know, talented. You make sure that you be able to harness all your talents, because the modern world is going to be very competitive if it's not already, and it's going to get more competitive. So if you have multiple talents, you'll be able to use different aspects of your life to be able to help yourself and your family, and therefore the community and then the society. Mm.
Yeah. Looking at your envoy period where you were serving Ghana overseas, what do you think the youth can learn from that experience?
That experience was very, very, very special, because Ghana's role in diplomacy is very, very much commended because of our founders Kwame Nkrumah, Buzia, and others. They set up a situation where in Africa, most diplomats know that Ghanaian diplomats are knowledgeable, and they consult, and we bring us all together. So that was very, very important in terms of actual traditional diplomacy. But at the time, too, President John Ejekun Kufuor's mantra was economic diplomacy,
right,
that we can do the you know, traditional diplomacy, but we have to also, you know, find a means to let businesses come, to Ghana. And this is something that I had been doing even before I became an ambassador. But when I was an ambassador both in Switzerland and Austria and then the United States, my goal was to bring businesses and make sure that the government create the right environment for businesses to nurture. And I was also always organizing Ghanaians, because sometimes the foreign investors want to, you know, partner with genuine local investors. They can't find them. So I was able to organize to help them have partnerships to be able to set up various enterprises and create jobs. So that was a very important aspect that you have to do. And most of this was, almost all for my time, was all done without even earning a dime out of it. Before I became ambassador, though, I had already worked very hard with my partners. And eventually, I ended up with one of my partners, George Owusu, where we started with transport. It didn't work. Then we went into, we were using ICT to try and transfer data from North America to Ghana and West Africa. It didn't work. We went into commodities. It didn't work. But we never gave up. We kept at it. We formed the EO group, Eduse Owusu Group. And we went through a lot of other challenges. Almost all the oil companies in the world who were the least interested in Africa, we went to them. We bought the Chinese, they couldn't believe the data. We bought the Irish, they didn't have enough money at the time. You know, it's called NX. Eventually, we were able to find Kosmos. You know, the Kosmos was a new American company who had already found oil in Equatorial Guinea for the first time. They had the personnel, and they were lucky to get the financial backing from the biggest private equity firm, Blackstone. And they gave a work program that they will be able to find the oil and produce it in record time. So they were able to satisfy all the criteria. And if you have that, you get very excited to bring such companies with creditability to come in and really make things happen. So, but before that, you have to be very smart, you know, as a local investor, because they will dangle millions in front of you. If you want the money alone, you will just go for it, and then you don't create wealth. So that's another aspect that I train the youth, that when you are in business, your main goal should be able to create wealth. So say thank you to the money, but I want some shares. Because if you don't do that, they will make the money, they can give you a couple of millions, and it will be gone in no time. And then you have lost the upstream. So that's the smart thing that we did. We had the opportunity to have made a lot of money at the time, but we decided to rather go for the shares so that would be part of the whole development process. And luckily for us, we were able to hit oil in large quantities for Ghana for the first time with commercial quantities, and it uplifted the whole country and helped. It's not the only one, but it actually helped to move Ghana from a highly indebted poor country into a middle-income country. So the government creating the right environment for businesses to grow. And it wasn't so much just for one side of politics, for both sides, but, both. So that period in Ghana was amazing. And we were able to benefit from it,
So how can a youth that you are engaging or you are training learn from this particular experience, as well as growing up and going to school and all that? How can they learn from this experience, this rich experience?
Yes. If you are a young person and you are thinking of leading a routine life, most likely you may not make it. So if you go into school and you have free time, use that time to do something else. You know, and if you do that, there will be opportunities, and you start trying them. You have to take risk. It has to be calculated risk, though. So you need to think through it, and then try and start testing some of them. Some of them you will fail, but if you keep at it, and you keep at it, one of them will take you to the next step, where you may be able to get funds to do a pilot study. And based upon the results, then you can go ahead, and you need to be able to market yourself. How do you tell your story right, be truthful, and maintain your integrity, but also show some positivity for the future? If you do that and keep on at it, you know, after a while, you will eventually make it. But at the beginning, you need to get the right education. But you always have to be innovative, curious, and find means to also use other talents. Because being a physician, I know that God didn't create human beings to be stuck in one way.
Right.
You have a lot of potential. The challenge is up to you, not to be sitting on the TV and just looking at one thing or wasting your time in drinking and smoking and doing drugs, some negativity, but turn it into positive. Look around the world and see, what can I do to change? What can I do to make the world better, my community better? You'll be amazed where the opportunities will come if you really think in those areas.
Mm. Yeah. What about the issue of mentorship, training the youth, bringing them up in whatever organizations, religious, traditional, to bring them up to where you want them to be, to learn from your experience?
Yes, I'm very, very, very happy that the present government has used part of the oil money to really, you know, give people free education. Mm. But we need to go to the next step, where we expose them to the practicalities of business.
Mm-hmm.
So they could be, you know, maybe interns, or they could be, you know, a little bit of visiting some of these companies and be challenging them to write projects. Look at it, how can you improve this? So that when you learn the traditional formal education, you need to also learn the aspect of how do you set up business. Challenge them to go do projects. You know, that is how science is very practical. So we need to have systems where some of these kids are exposed.
Mm.
And you'll be able to select people who have talents here and talents there. And if you do that and give them the challenge them to also set up companies, and it because of the modern technology, sometimes it's not that difficult, you know. So those are avenues that you can really use. And then you have they can use NGOs to do workshops, but you should also find a ways to organize people who have been successful in business to try and pick up these young guys and mentor them and also show them. Because sometimes you can read a book for a while, but if you don't see it in practice, it's very difficult for you to really make it have any positive effect on society.
Talk to me about your philanthropical work. Yes. You made mention of those in your book. How is this impacting the average Ghanaian, or how will that impact the average African?
Yes, my goal is to make sure that my philanthropy, I coordinate with others who right. are the traditional ones,
mm-hmm.
but mine, in terms of a DUSEF Foundation, is basically to use our own, you know, funds,
mm-hmm.
and also start off with youth workshops.
Mm-hmm.
We try and pick up people before they even get to college,
right,
and have these workshops where we train them in terms of how to do business. We also train them in healthy living, and most important, because the number one problem for Africa, and I want to make it abundantly clear,
right.
I'm not a young man anymore, is the enemy is us. I've been all over the world. We try and blame colonialism, no, the enemy is us. There's a word in Akan language called abro. It doesn't even have an English name,
right.
abro.
Right.
This idea of negativity, everybody trying to pull each other down, enviness, vindictiveness. If we don't stop that as a nation, or we don't stop that as Africans, we won't go anywhere, because you have people who have been educated in Oxford, you name it. But if you have that negativity, it never frees you to be able to look and on the positive side. So that is something that we may even have to develop a national policy,
mm-hmm.
a continental policy, to try and switch things around and let these kids think about how do we work on the positive tone? How do we work as a team? How do we look at results, not so much about the processes alone? So the challenge for the modern future is to use your education to move up into technology, coordinate with others. You have to have partners and work as a team. So somebody is doing this, how can I help him make better? And you'll be surprised as when you help someone, it creates another avenue for you, instead of trying to pull each other down.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll be like a pot of crabs, pulling each other down till somebody comes and puts you on top of fire and eats you all up. That has been the problem in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the number one challenge for me when I meet the youth, and I meet them quite often, is to try and change their mindsets
uh-huh.
from the abroad negative mode into the positive mode.
Mm.
How can I help myself and work with others to help all of us?
Mm.
That is very fundamental.
There's also this thinking that once they are in government, well, this is government's thing. You do the barest minimum. You don't want to give your all. And they do a lackadaisical job, and then it affects everybody. When you meet people in your position, you've worked in government and in private sector, if this is the attitude, where does this lead the country?
That is an attitude that has to change, and it all comes down to that abroad situation. Because when I was in government, I had my team set up. Everybody should set their goals, and we had to sacrifice. We can't work when we were in diplomacy. They were closing at 3 p.m. I said, how can you do that? You have to close at 5. Because somebody closes from work, they need to come and get a visa. You are also gone even before they close from work, for instance. I was skipping lunch, eat my African breakfast, skip lunch, and meet Ghanaian business people or anybody interested to send businesses. You have to go the extra mile in government. But most of us are stuck with the old mentality that the government belongs to a colonialist or somebody. And therefore, I'm just doing my the minimum that I can do, and then I get my share and go. That doesn't help. So we need to make sure the civil service too is modified to be very proactive, to be smaller and more effective and run as a business.
Right.
You know. So those things needs discipline from the top and foresight and strategy. Mm-hmm. If we don't do that, it used to be 60% when I was a young man of the revenue goes into civil service. Now it's 70, and it's going up to 80. So before we realize it, will hit 100 in no time. And every revenue the government gets goes to gets about 6 million people. And what happens to the rest of 24 million? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the private sector. So it's very important that we make sure that people who are working for the government know they are servants to begin with. And they need to produce results. Mm. They don't just get stuck in their ways, and they find means to sometimes really frustrate you. Some of us who are trying to do business right now in Ghana, it's not easy sometimes because people try and put all kinds of cares on you because maybe they don't want to bring you down. That is a major, major problem that we all need to find means to change and have a paradigm shift to move into positivity so we can help each other to change
Dr. Bawedu, before we go, what is your message to the youth and those who are seeking to better their lives based on the writings of your book?
Mainly my main message to the youth, because those of us who are older may have missed it, is for them not to lose hope. Because the youth is the future. Africa has a lot more youth than any other continent. And to work hard and persevere. They shouldn't play the victim role that I've not been treated. My forefathers weren't treated right. I'm going through racism now. I'm going through, you know, you shouldn't play the victim role. Move to the positive side. Have a positive goal and keep working hard and work with others towards trying to get us out of this because it's possible. Ghana is leading it. I know other countries could join. We will need to connect with the diasporans and see how we can bring our energies together to really uplift all of us out of poverty. And the best way is through creating jobs.
Thank you very much. Dr. Kwame Bawedu-Se is the former Ghanaian ambassador to the U.S. He joins us live from VOA Studios right here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Akothee featuring Diamond with My Sweet Love. And then Akman ends it all with Me and You.
You know, si na ujanja kwako, maisho na kinywa baba, kwako si se mi. And you know, macho yangu kwako, jeuri si na baba, kwako si he mi. Wasije kuteka viwembe.
Situzimie mama wakati ya fitina mimi na tamsu najua wengi wala hai si nisije kesho kaniviacha ngamba kwenye uwezo sina nikabaki na ubwa mangapi ulishazusha tuzonge mangapi lengo ni nyang'anye tonge oh mangapi nyanga kachinja na ng'ombe kikwapi sifanga itutishili zombe kwanza piripiri na washia nini siri siri yetu ena mimi
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Mr. Tino, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, horns do not grow before the head. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.